Oh, and good morning. Welcome to another edition of the Debrief Podcast here on FingerLakes1.com. I'm Josh Durso, joined as always, or it's become as always, Ted Baker, Finger Lakes Morning News host, WGVA, WAUB. You hear him Monday through Friday. What are those stations? Give me those stations.
We're on FM, for those who didn't know. And by the way, the AM 1240 transfer is back. Not quite in full power, but it's getting there. In Geneva, it's 95.9 FM and 1240 AM WGVA. In Auburn, it's 98.1 FM and 1590 AM WAUB.
And that seems pretty reasonable. But you guys are on FM?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
It's all over town now.
It's amazing, the number of people, and we talked about it last week, the number of people who do not realize that just because you might be primarily known for being AM, or maybe some of the folks are more leaning that way, I guess, or you just think you're not on FM at all.
Well, a lot of it is that the news talk audience tends to be a little older audience, so most of them just grew up with AM 1240. That's all they've ever known. But it was a great lesson for us that no matter how many times we say it, you still don't always get your message out. So we're trying to come up with some good, clever way of letting people know.
So we talked about it this morning on your show. We have some familiar faces in Cayuga County. For the fifth straight mayoral race, the Cayuga County Republican Committee has endorsed Cayuga County legislator Timothy Lattimore as its candidate for the Auburn race. And for the fourth consecutive time, which actually I had forgotten about, the Democratic Committee decided to go with the incumbent, Michael Quill. Wow. Like, the conversation we had this morning was mainly leaning around the whole idea of, from my perspective, parties need to do a better job of getting people engaged and involved. How can you have the same race four times in a row, five times in a row, and on either side expect a different outcome?
Well, there's a healthy amount of ego involved in politics. I don't know Mayor Quill real well. I know Tim Lattimore just a little bit. I think he has a fairly healthy ego, probably, as a lot of people do in politics. So, you know, you lose. Tracy Matrano, we talked about, she declared pretty much the day after the election to go at it again. So you always think that, especially if the races are relatively close, and I don't know how close they've been over the last few times. And, of course, Tim Lattimore was elected mayor before, so he thinks he can get back.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I think, you know, especially for a challenger this time, given the fact that Auburn just won the DRI, this second most recent time around, I guess, would be now, we're thinking about. Maybe not. But they've got that money coming in. They're moving through the process. There doesn't seem to be a whole lot of controversy attached to the DRI process. Some concerns were voiced initially, but a lot of those seem to have been quelled, at least a little bit, by the way the city has handled it thus far. It just, to me, this is one of those scenarios where if you are a county committee, and this is pretty much every county, you have an opportunity to start getting some new faces involved. You should be getting some new faces involved. What it seems like ends up happening oftentimes, especially in smaller counties, is the committees end up being comprised of folks who are, we'll call them stakeholders, people who are interested in or already hold an elected office and less interested in and more already holding. And it creates this terrible scenario in my mind where you have folks who aren't really thinking about the process and aren't really thinking about what the committee's role is supposed to be. And that's supposed to be to build the party up, to get more folks engaged, to get more folks understanding what your messaging and what your platform is all about. That's really, really important, especially in local politics. And I think that's missing. And I don't think Cayuga County is the only example of that. Seneca County, Ontario County, Wayne County, Yates County, I think it happens pretty much everywhere in the Finger Lakes. And it's a little disappointing, I guess, but on the flip side of it is that there's such an opportunity to capitalize on that and actually make some positive change in that way. So I'm sitting over here asking myself, having now lived through what would be this will be my fifth election year here in the Finger Lakes with Finger Lakes 1, and it's like I'm waiting to see something different happen. And unfortunately, it's not happening. And I'm not seeing that engagement that I thought would have come along and come around by now.
Well, I think it's a little bit path of least resistance. So I've got somebody that wants to run versus somebody that I have to drag to it kicking and screaming. We've talked about how, and I don't know how much of it is the time commitment, how much of it is the hassle, how much of it is the divisiveness in our politics that's percolating all the way down to the local level. If there's just, we may see more of this. There just may not be as many people who want to do it, so it's going to be more the people who are already kind of in the system. You know, it's easier for Tim Lattimore to mount a campaign because he's got all the people, you know, he can count on the same people that always work for him versus somebody brand new coming in off the street that has to put together an organization and go through all this. So I think we might have to get used to more of this. There just may not be as many people interested in doing these jobs.
So one of the issues that came up in the last couple weeks when the Seneca Falls Town Committee, and we're going to talk about Seneca Falls a little later in the program, but one of the items that popped up when the Republican committee met for the town of Seneca Falls to make their to choose their flight of candidates, they were only able to come up with two individuals for a total of three open seats. They came up with someone for town supervisor Mike Farrar. They came up with someone for one of the two open, what will be two open council seats, excuse me, and Don Dyson, but they weren't able to come up with anybody for that third seat. And this is the cautionary tale right here is, this is where it ends up. It ends up in that scenario. Like a lot, I feel like a lot of people assume that there's always going to be someone ready to take over or ready to fill the role. But unfortunately, in small rural communities, we see that's not the case often. And what ends up happening is you have races. I can recall two separate races in the last 5 years that I've covered up in Red Creek that have actually had vacancies last through the election. Vacancies.
Right.
So it's difficult. And when you think about that, you're not just saying that no one wants to run. You're also saying that no one wants to apply to be appointed. Think about the implication of that. And that is just, it's, you know, when you start to look at what the state is trying to do, you know, when Albany is trying to control these really small villages and trying to find ways that they can manipulate them a little further, and you have no engagement or very little engagement from the elected or from taxpayers, constituents who could potentially be elected officials, that it's a recipe for disaster, because who's going to go to bat for you, right?
Well, I have my own personal story to tell, which was a couple of years ago I was asked if I was interested in a spot on the Rushville Town Board. I don't remember if it would have been to run. I think it might have been to have been appointed. And I was really intrigued by the idea, and then I thought, okay, number one, I have this crazy sports broadcast schedule, so, you know, I don't want to miss meetings. And then number two, I thought about what goes into that. You know, do I want somebody knocking on my door on Saturday morning to complain about the pothole or something? And I just went, you know, no thanks. So, I guess I'm part of the problem.
Well, and it's interesting, too. You also, I mean, and we've talked a little bit about it, you also had the caveat of, you're in the media.
Right, that creates its own set of problems.
Exactly,
I mean, obviously.
That's its own challenge.
Right.
But, you know, there are, for every, I'm not sure what the committee structures look like at the county and town level, but I'm going to assume that you're talking about roughly a dozen people in each setting. So maybe roughly a dozen people per town that make up each committee. And, you know, that just isn't a lot. And quite oftentimes it's people who, I don't want to say can mail it in, the people who are filling those roles, but people who, for one reason or another, either they have busy schedules and they can't really facilitate the kind of interaction that's needed to bolster their roster or their bench, or they just don't really have an interest because they're there for personal gain. You have that push and pull, and it's just a really troubling trend, I think, for local government and local politics. And one of the things that we'll end up talking about later is the audit that was just released about Seneca Falls. And actually, you know what, we can just talk about that now because it fits.
Right. I was going to say that we talked about that this morning, that the tasks that these people are expected to accomplish. Exactly. So here's a crazy idea. I wonder if we're going to have a time or if it will become necessary at some point to not have a lot of these positions be elected and simply hire professionals to do them and pay them a full-time salary. So you hire your professional town board and pay them to do nothing else and find people, you know, go through resumes, find people who have whatever sort of municipal experience and do it that way.
It's an interesting idea. Basically, just to give a quick recap, the audit essentially says that there were a little over $800,000 in various overspends, like 250-some thousand of it was on unapproved, not approved properly, like 12, 13 individual expenses along the way, brought the total cost of the new municipal building, which is located on Ovid Street, was built after a fire in 2004, 10 years later, $4.55 million. A lot of money. But it is interesting. Now, my thought is a lot of these towns and villages are so lean that instead of trying to make the town board or the village board or the mayor and the supervisor be sort of the CEO of the entity, I think it would be much easier to actually hire the professional staff to run the municipality when the legislators are not legislating.
That it might be, to go back to what you talked about, the state wanting to exert more control, maybe there need to be state or regional boards that do these things. Maybe we need, 8 regional board of construction overseers groups that anything in a 6-county area that involves a municipal construction project, this professional board will oversee it. I mean, it's a pretty radical change. I mean, it's not like that's going to happen anytime in the next couple of years, but a lot of what we get into in these podcasts are sort of overall trends and looking at the future. So yeah, Maybe there's going to need to be some change in the way some of these things are done.
Well, I think it's interesting too, because you look at sort of the way things have, and maybe my thought to that, my reaction to that, after we got done talking this morning, I was thinking to myself, boy, if you needed like a catalyst to really get people engaged, to really get people going, threaten that. That would be the ultimate. If the state said if the towns and the villages and the counties cannot come up with the appropriate structures or the appropriate systems to handle these issues, to handle these projects, big or small, we are going to come in with professional staff and do it for you. So you can either go out and do it yourself, or you can go hire someone to do it for you, but you have to do it and it has to meet X standard.
But you know what the reaction to that would be? Apathy. I don't think anybody would really care. I believe this has always been one of my theories of politics. I think part of the divisiveness and everything we see is by design to intentionally turn people off from the system. Because if the vast majority of the population disengages, then who gets to be in charge? That small core of those same candidates and everything that we talked about before. So I sometimes think that it's somewhat by design to turn the public off. It's easier to control when fewer people are engaged.
Yeah, and we see, I was actually kind of surprised. I guess I knew it was coming, but I was a little bit surprised at the volume. I've been going through the Board of Election sheets that outline every single race that's coming up or race that's pending this year. And there are a ton of offices, local offices, hyper-local offices, coroners, justices, council seats, supervisors, you name it. It's up for grabs this year. And in some cases, you could have scenarios where entire city councils or entire boards turn over. If the elections play out the right way, which actually invites another issue that I like to bring up around this time to sort of frame out what could potentially go wrong after an election cycle like this one. Take the city of Geneva or the city of Canandaigua. Both, I believe, have pretty much every single member up for election this time around. And it creates the possibility, and Jackie Augustine has talked about this a lot, where you could lose all of your institutional knowledge for that board, for that governing body. I think that is the big risk when you have these, and it's part of the reason why I think, and I believe the city of Canandaigua might have gone through this a couple of years ago, where they actually switched some things up in their in the way that the city functions to ensure that there was overlap of terms. So, and this might be the reset year for
right.
where it begins, so that it would be more staggered out throughout.
Well, and the jobs have become much more complicated. One of the things that I have done over the years as a scout leader in Boy Scouts is I teach the communications merit badge. Part of that is attending a public meeting. So I take a group of scouts, and I went to a school board meeting one time, Marcus Whitman School Board, and I've done this a long time. I could barely understand some of the things they were talking about. I mean, it's just, it's so esoteric, and the knowledge is so deep, and you're expected to manage these millions of dollars and interact with the state government and the federal government. It's a hard job. So maybe it's outgrowing the citizen volunteer, and maybe we need these things to be professionally done.
Yeah, it's interesting, especially when you start to talk about, we want our government to be more efficient. That might be the easiest way to make it more efficient.
I mean, that's why a lot of cities have gone to the city manager model, because rather than just having the mayor becomes a little more of an executive and a figurehead, and the city manager, who's got the training and the nuts and bolts knowledge, is the one that deals in contracts and money and grants and all that kind of thing.
So members of the Assembly Minority Conference this week called on Governor Cuomo and legislative leaders to include critical measures to reduce costs, boost economic growth, and improve New Yorkers' quality of life, particularly in upstate, in their version of the 2019-2020 fiscal budget. Their goals, they want to make the tax cap permanent. We've seen that before. Provide a living wage for direct care workers. Ensure the middle class tax cut is on track. Increase CHIPS funding as well. And then, of course, provide relief for unfunded mandates. Basically, none of these things are probably going to happen. That's just the way it goes. I was actually kind of surprised. The last couple of years, and maybe it's because Republicans have zero control of any of the legislative chambers anymore. Last couple of years, there's been a pretty good amount of press and pretty good amount of attention on this. This year, there was effectively none. I saw one out of the Albany blogs and Albany newspapers that I follow. I think I saw like two or three stories, and that was it about it. They didn't dive into really any of the proposals. It was basically as if everyone was looking straight past it and what Democrats are trying to do or wanting to do. Is this a bad sign for upstate New York?
Well, I think...
Because most of those proposals are geared toward upstate New York.
The real root problem is this whole budget process. I've never seen, I'd be curious if there's any other state anywhere in the country where it's so dominated by the executive. I don't understand. The idea is supposed to be that the budget is introduced by the legislative branch as a package of bills. It gets debated, it gets amended, it gets talked about, it gets voted on, and then the executive can sign it or veto it. In New York, the budget is pretty much whatever the governor says it's going to be, and everybody else can go pound sand. And I don't get that. So the Republicans can put out anything they want. Like you said, I know, and they know it isn't going anywhere.
Yeah, it's interesting because this was, I thought of this around the same time that I had seen a story. Basically, it was talking about the upstate downstate split concept that's been getting lots of attention over the last few weeks. There was this idea that was thrown out there, and I believe it was by the same legislator that threw the initial proposal out there, to go to a one county, one vote system, where each county had one vote or one representative, and that representative represented the county and had one vote in the grand scheme of things to, and the amount of change that would be required to make that happen. Of all the things, it's almost like they managed to find something more radical than just splitting upstate and downstate. They did it. It goes back to this conversation where, I guess you put it pretty well in that it is really heavily leaning toward the executive branch, but it isn't even really the executive branch unless you only consider the governor the executive branch and not anyone else associated with the governor. In theory, it should still be a team effort, but it doesn't really even seem to be that. It does pretty much just seem to be what the governor, what Governor Cuomo wants to see happen. And this is just, it's gotten to a point now, I think, where upstate New York is in this really weird spot. Now, the governor could continue to support upstate New York in the ways that he has through the DRI and different economic development initiatives, spending some money here or there, that kind of thing. Or he could really stick it to the Finger Lakes region and upstate as a whole. Let's not forget that last year, while everybody was talking about the incinerator bill and how that was a no-brainer and Republicans and Democrats agreed, that did not pass the assembly led by Democrats. And as of now, looks like it's going to vote. A lot of its supporters seem to feel very confident about it. You know what? It's one of those scenarios where I don't know that if it made it to the governor's desk that he would sign it, that he would sign a bill that bans incinerators from the Finger Lakes or from a place like Romulus. It brings politics into the fold too much, I feel like, because at that point it will feel very vengeful.
Well, and that theory has been floated that the governor intentionally sticks it to upstate New York because upstate New York doesn't vote for him.
Right.
And knowing our governor, you can't just dismiss that idea out of hand. I don't know that it's necessarily true, but the fact that it's even worth considering says a lot.
Well, and I had actually brought up to when a couple weeks ago when Jackie was here, we were talking about the AIM funding, and I said, what if this was just a smokescreen? What if instead of the governor really wanting to take this away, he just wanted to put it out there that it was going to be that it could be taken away, and to force Republican lawmakers to spend their energy and their political capital on that, as opposed to something else. And then afterwards, he can say, well, see, I conceded to them, and I gave them something, and it isn't anything new. It isn't anything exciting. It isn't actually anything that even really helps anybody. It's just one of the many ways that the governor was working to chip away at small municipalities.
Well, and it's also just, it's systemic in New York. You mentioned earlier just about the state wanting to exert more control. And it's the same thing with these formulas where we send our tax money to Albany and they decide how much of it we're going to get back. How about we don't send it there in the first place and we keep our own? I mean, that would be a start, is more local control. But I think ultimately the problem that I have with the Republican economic development plan is it seems to assume that the only problem in New York is high taxes, regulations. Roll those all back, and businesses will come flocking to upstate New York. I don't think that's the case for some of the reasons that we've talked about. I think there have been changes economically in rural America, not just in upstate New York, that might be beyond the capacity of governments to solve. We've talked about it in the past. These big industrial plants, where people in rural parts of America used to be able to get jobs with a high school education, no specialized training, those are gone for a lot of reasons that I don't really think have much to do with taxes and regulations. I think it has to do with more public ownership of companies, where the responsibility now is to the stockholder rather than to the residents of the town. So I think there's a seismic shift going on, and the two political parties in New York are trying to cram it into a political box where I don't really think it goes.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because we talked about the Amazon debate when the Finger Lakes region was briefly touted as maybe an option. It does. It goes back to that point that there are issues at play here that wouldn't allow an Amazon or a giant mega company to come in. Infrastructure being one of them. The infrastructure just wouldn't support it. The workforce wouldn't.
If they wanted to, but they don't want to. I mean, for all the reasons we talked about, if I'm a CEO of a company, let's say I've got you know, 8 plants spread out across the United States, and I want to be able to go visit them once in a while. Do I want to fly into the little regional airport and have to change planes in Chicago and then get a ride down, or do I want to be in New York City where I can go direct from any major airport to JFK or LaGuardia, get off the plane, get on a train, and be to my plant in a few minutes?
Yeah, it's interesting, and there are some issues, I think, with folks moving towards urban centers and away from the rural settings and the rural villages. I'm not sure that when folks talk about tourism as being a lifeblood of a place like the Finger Lakes, I think if a couple new or different economic factors sort of turn against the region, that may not be enough to support what ultimately still is here.
No, I don't think it is. Tourism is great, and we're making the most out of it in the Finger Lakes, but those jobs are often seasonal. They're not as high-paying as an industrial factory job. And so, ultimately, to solve the problem, we have a real aversion in our country to handing money from some people to other people. You know, it's ultimately what upstate New York probably would need is an infusion of cash from downstate New York. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to give it. I mean, nobody wants to give up their hard-earned money. It's funny, depending on how you package it. If you call it DRI and give a town $10 million, everybody celebrates and thinks that's great. If we proposed a system where every resident of upstate New York whose income was below a certain level got a guaranteed $10,000 check from the state, there'd be howls of protests from here to Albany.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's one of those scenarios where I'm not sure there even is a solution right now, honestly, when it comes to the, because the issues are so, they touch so many other issues that it just becomes very difficult to even facilitate or manage a solution.
There are a lot of things conspiring against rural America right now. So we may all be faced with a choice pretty soon to either move to the city or be poor. I don't know. I that's a pretty stark choice, and I don't think it has to quite come to that point, but you see where I'm getting.
Yeah. So let's talk about some schools. With frequent snowstorms and other weather-related incidents hitting central New York and the Finger Lakes this season, some area schools are starting to get close to their number of planned cancellation days. What does that mean? Is it time to re-examine the system? Why on earth is a district tied to a certain number of days when you're talking about something that fundamentally comes down to safety? It just doesn't make a damn bit of sense.
Drives me absolutely nuts. I don't know, is it the state education commissioner who makes this decision? How hard is it for somebody in Albany, whether it's the commissioner or a board or somebody, to say it's been a hard winter, you get 5 freebies this year? Problem solved in 10 seconds. It is so monumentally dumb. And we saw this the other day when the day after the storm that we had, all the schools were open. If that storm had hit in November, when no days had been taken yet, they all would have been closed or delayed. So now we've got local superintendents forced to make this decision based not on the safety of their students and staff, but on some state formula. Where is the state on this? How hard is it to say it's been a rough winter, it's okay if you go 5 days under the minimum this year? Or, I don't know if this comes from the U.S. Education Department. I mean, somebody's got to be able to use some sense. This is where people lose confidence in their government. How hard is it to say it's been a bad winter, it's okay?
Well, and then the other part of it is this is one of those policies where it kind of seems like it exists because there's this assumption that districts are just going to completely take advantage of it, or like that it's going to be abused so badly.
Right.
You're going to see schools taking 30, 40 days. No, it's not going to happen. Like, the decision process will be the exact same no matter what. And to me, it's just miraculous that, you know, when you talk about these different factors, it's like, okay, so is there a certain measure of snow that falls within a certain period of time? And that's even... That part of this whole process, this decision-making process, is shaky and questionable and not, I don't think it's very consistent across districts. I know, you know, the various schools and districts, from what I understand, will work with the emergency management office in each county to sort of, they've got eyes everywhere, deputies on the road, they've got salt trucks and everything. They're communicating with those folks, so in theory, they know what's going on. But it just, it drives me insane, is like, and perhaps most frustratingly, is the discussion, and I believe you mentioned it at one point this week on your radio show, parents are using school as daycare. And they're using it as childcare, and I get it. It's consistent. It's regular. If you are a parent and you do not plan for the unforeseen, that's not on the district. That's not on the rest of the school. That's not on other parents to have to find a safe way for their kids to get to school because you don't want to see school canceled because, you know, your little Johnny can stand out in the snow at the street corner and wait for the bus. That just to me is we're smarter than that.
Well,
you know, we're better than that. We really should be able to problem solve through this one.
One of the economic changes when we talk about these greater trends has been that increasingly it takes two incomes to get by. In 1950s Leave It to Beaver America, dad went to work, mom stayed home. And if the kids missed school, they stayed home with mom. Well, very often that's not the case anymore. The only thing I would say, because we regularly make fun of what we call the flipper schools on the Finger Lakes Morning News, because there's this herd mentality. We'll come in on a morning and we'll have 15 two-hour delays.
Yep.
And two or three of them flip over to closed. And before you know it, boom, 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 like a row of dominoes, they all flip over to closed. So I guess that's the first thing is, make the decision. Make your own call for your district. Don't look around and see what the other people are doing. But I think the other thing hanging over the heads of the superintendents who have to make this call is liability. We're in a lawsuit society, and if somebody gets hurt in an accident or slips and falls on the ice because school was open on a bad day, here come the lawsuits. So they're being put in a very difficult situation. The only thing I would say locally is I would err a little bit more on the side of caution earlier in the season, because we see this every year. We see that 1.5 inches of snow in November and everybody goes with the school day off, and then we get now to February and March, and now, you know, if it snows 1.5 feet tomorrow, everybody's going to try to go to school because they're out of days and they're backed up against the wall and they don't know what to do.
Well, and the reason why I wanted to talk about it is because I'm assuming that Monday is going to be one of those days again. They're saying we're going to get some snow Sunday night, and it'll probably be close, and maybe you get 3 inches, maybe you get 6 inches, but that seems to be the window, at least using this year as the model,
right?
Where schools start to make that decision, or they start to think about it. I never knew that there was so much herd mentality in the process, but obviously there is, because I've even, up at MCC, where my girlfriend's enrolled right now, they don't close the college until Rush Henrietta closes school for the day. So that's the, you know, there is that sort of districts looking at other entities and other districts to sort of make that call.
Well, and every district is different too. If you're, you know, for example, the Geneva City schools, mostly contained in a small area, you don't have some of the hills and valleys. I mean, you know, my school district, Marcus Whitman, spread over Ontario and Yates County, you've got some, you know, some of these people live at 2,000 feet elevation up on a hilltop, and they might be getting a foot of snow when down in the valley they're getting 4 inches. So you have to make those decisions accordingly. But I guess it would just be nice if the decision could be made by the local. And again, it's that control from above. I mean, the state tells you what to do. The federal government tells you what to do. How about we leave it up to the local school district to decide what's safe for their kids and trust that they know how to do it?
Yeah, that's that seems to be the easy way. And it would also, it seems, it, you know, as you start to strip away some of the regulation, I think you also get into a place where you're spending a little bit money on federal government and state government, and you're saving money, and all of a sudden everybody's happy because they get to make decisions and their checkbook's a little less effective.
But I just, you know, to go back to the start of this topic, it blows my mind that nobody from the state was able to make an announcement several days ago or weeks ago and say, it's all right, we got you covered, we understand, You got no choice. So if you don't go, I think it's 180 days, I think is the requirement. Yeah. I could be off there. So, okay, everybody this year, make it 175. And if that's a problem for you, you know, hello, Oswego, then give us a call and we'll talk about it.
Yeah, that's probably the big, you have certain places where there is more risk or there is more need for exceptions, for movement.
Yeah, I mean, if you're North Rose Wolcott, you've probably got 250 inches of snow this year. I mean, it just snows there all the time.
Yeah. A quick editor's note, I think I referred to Consetta as my girlfriend. She is my fiance.
She didn't catch that.
I caught it. So let's talk about this. You're a Yates County resident. This interesting story with the midwife who was arrested twice last year, between I believe November and December, and then we had this sort of uprising of support from the Mennonite community, from the rural communities down there, coming out and basically saying this person is, for all intents and purposes, innocent. She's been practicing properly. Everything is fine. Everybody is alive and well. But she was charged with felonies. and it appears to be primarily connected to this idea that New York State has some exceptional expectations for what a midwife has to do to actually become a practicing midwife, which is part of the issue, I guess. But then the other part of it is I saw part of the headline that said Yates County public health officials are working to ensure that this type of situation doesn't come up again. Now, where were they 8 months ago, a year ago, 2 years ago? I think one of the stories that I had read, maybe from the Chronicle Express, that out of 150-something home births that had taken place in the last year or 2 years, more than half had likely been performed by Elizabeth Kalin, who was ultimately arrested and facing felony charges. Is like, this happened on your watch. I think there has to be some accountability there, not just on the person, but, you know, these humans are being born and they're being accounted for, right? Like, they aren't just slipping away into the ether. Like, they're humans existing and living in Yates County. And how is Yates County not accounting for the illegal practice of one of what is only maybe one, two, or three midwives serving the county?
Well, it's an interesting topic that really doesn't get covered all that much in the media, and that is there's kind of a wink and a nod treatment given to the Mennonites in certain areas because they have their religious beliefs, and I think it's admirable, really, that the counties try to work with them wherever possible. They're able to have their own schools and have their kids go to school. This particular issue, this is where my libertarian side kicks in. I support the woman. If somebody wants to hire someone to perform a service and they feel confident that that person can perform that service in a proper manner, what business is it of the county, the state of New York, or anybody else? Really? I mean, and it also, it kind of opens the whole thing about licensing, which is that the primary purpose of licensing in our society is to raise revenue for a government agency. I mean, we don't have driver's licenses because we want everybody to be safe drivers. We have driver's licenses because it raises a whole bunch of money. Seriously, I mean that's my 2 cents worth. So that's where I veer from my lefty liberal leanings to my libertarian leanings.
Well, and it's like clearly the state has an unreasonable expectation because I believe New York State is maybe one of only two states in the entire U.S. that have the level of standard or the licensing requirements that they do, and it just why on earth are you going to, now? I had seen a story this morning, and I heard a story this morning coming in on the radio about a couple in Florida who is practicing dentistry out of their garage. Completely different ball game. There's like an act of fraud, I guess, being perpetuated there that I don't really see in this scenario. where everybody understood, it seems, who she was, what she was doing, and it seems like her track record was pretty good. You know, we aren't talking about you know, deceased children. We aren't talking about children who or mothers who were, you know, not with us anymore because of it. And unless that, if that comes out, that completely changes everything, I think.
Well,
but, you know, at this point, it's like you have a scenario where this woman was completing the task and the responsibilities at hand without issue. And, you know.
Right. Well, and that's where it puts the county in a bind, because if the law isn't applied equally, people lose respect for the law. But I've actually done quite a bit of reading over the years, because I was always fascinated by the Amish and Mennonite cultures. And one of the sort of principles that guides the Mennonites is something called unequal yoking, where they don't want to be tied to the outside world. That's why it's okay to have battery-powered electricity, but it's not okay to be hooked up to the wire, because now you've become reliant on the outside world. The principle is that you should all be reliant on yourself. So the whole principle of licensing goes against that. So it's like I said, it's an interesting, there have been a lot of accommodations made over the years for the Mennonites to try to allow them to live their lives as much as possible according to their beliefs while still maintaining some sort of government control. So they might not have electric milk tanks, but the milk still has to be inspected to make sure it reaches safety standards. So it's kind of a tough call. But I think in this particular case, if she's performing these services, and everybody knows, the people who hire her know she isn't licensed, but they know she's good, they know she'll do the job, and at a price that they agree on. So to me, that's a perfect example where government could stay out of the way.
Well, and it sounds like she's the go-to for the Mennonite community right down there. I mean, it sounds like that's pretty much who they go with as their first option, and you go from there.
So sometimes you wonder, is the law, you know, at what point do you stop just being punitive?
Right.
This sounds like more of a case, and it's always, yeah, you know, a bunch of felonies, instead of saying, okay, look, wink, nod, slap on the wrist, here's a fine. Don't do it ever again, wink, wink, wink.
Yeah, and it really, the other part of this that I feel like wasn't really discussed much was the whole idea, the burden that this put on the community who was actively taking advantage of her services. I mean, think about the families who basically had to, I don't know, I guess in the middle of a pregnancy, find a new midwife.
Right,
a place
right
where obviously there aren't many midwives. Like, that just to me seems illogical to not, if you're going to press charges, if you're going to go the legal route there, to not already have, months before even, as you're building your case, to not have folks in there to make sure that the transition is seamless, because it doesn't sound like it was.
No.
So
it would make a really fascinating, you know, if you ever want to do a big kind of enterprise series, just the whole way that we interact with the Mennonite community in upstate New York.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same thing, you know, with the Amish in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. I read a really good book about some of the compromises that were reached over the years where trying to serve the interests of the Amish population and the interests of the government at the same time. And in that area, they've been able to really work together, as they have here, I think, for the most part,
yeah,
to sort of come to some compromises where everybody gets at least a piece of what they want.
So two judges have been censured in Wayne County. We talked about this morning on your radio show. Palmyra Judge William Abbott and Huron Judge Kathy Watchman have both been reprimanded by the New York State Commission of Judicial Conduct. Watchman is accused of holding a preliminary hearing without the defendant's lawyer present in 2017, and Abbott was accused of threatening to refuse arraignments if police did not unlock his personal vehicle. Neither are lawyers, and this was the second time that Abbott had been censored. Wow. The angle that we talked about it this morning on was essentially to say that local government works best when you have good people doing a job. 99% of the time, good people are doing the job. But every now and then, bad one slips through the cracks. And this is one of those areas where you want to talk about, you know, we can talk about Seneca Falls and how they got hit hard with this audit. No one was thrown in jail over the board not approving some expenditures. This is a scenario where if you have a judge who is not doing his job, his or her job properly or to the fullest extent, you could literally end up with people in jail.
Yeah, I think in this case, I wouldn't go so far as to say a bad person. I would say a person who momentarily forgot how to compartmentalize. You know, you can't let your personal dispute with the police creep into the performance of your job. I'm not aware of all the circumstances involved. I don't know why you would have a hearing without counsel for a defendant present, but... And it goes back to, again, we always seem to get into these themes when we do these conversations, but, you know, that theme of professionalism. Would we be better off with appointed judges with a background in the law? Because, as you said, there is no background in the law. I can run for judge if I want, and if I'm popular enough and I win, now here I am ruling on complex legal issues with no legal training or specific knowledge at all.
And that's one of the things that's really puzzled me about the legal system as a whole. With all of the talk and all the discussion around some of the more difficult cases that we've seen, I think of the couple cases up in SOTUS, where you're actually seeing arraignments and such for heinous crimes happening in town court. Now, a lot of those pretty much get moved into county court almost immediately when the county steps into the prosecution side, but it just boggles the mind that with as advanced as we are in this world and with as, frankly, as willing as Albany and governments are willing to spend money, that this is not one of those areas where we don't look at maybe a better option, a potentially better option. Now, I'm not saying that you're not going to also have bad actors in those situations, too, because you can.
Right.
You can definitely have that. But there does seem to be, and just sort of reading through the rulings from the commission with these two instances, it kind of appears to be a scenario, I don't want to say a pattern, but an instance where you have people, maybe like you say, momentarily forgetting or not being able to completely compartmentalize issues like this. Now, the flip side of it is, you know, with Judge Abbott, you know, you have somebody who served for something like 40 plus years.
Right. Second censure in 40 years. So.
Yeah. I mean, you're talking about the last one that occurred, I believe, back in 89, I believe is what it said. So, you know, long time apart, but, you know, perhaps this person is not the best fit to be judge in Palmyra.
Well, maybe, but also circumstances matter too. So in the case of holding a hearing without the counsel present, was it a legitimate mistake or oversight? Was it done because there was a history with this person? I mean, I think the context matters as well.
Yeah, and I think to that end, we see few enough of these types of we don't see a lot of judges getting reprimanded in this way very often. So I think I would assume that the bar has to be pretty high for what's expected in terms of proof to justify these types of rulings. I honestly do. It doesn't to me seem plausible that, you know, they're just taking a couple statements and just moving on from it. These are instances that clearly one happened in 2017 and we're just hearing about it now. The other one happened last year and we're just hearing about it now. You're talking about months and months, if not years, of effort going into this. So that's a part of it. And there again, you know, we're back to this topic. But when you live in a small community and you have a limited pool of individuals who are even interested on the onset to run for something like judge or justice, you're in this scenario where a bad actor could potentially stay in a position of power like that for a longer period of time than they actually deserve or than they should for the, you know, the real good of the community.
Well, and on the other hand, though, the fact that there are so few of these would tend to indicate that people are doing a pretty good job. And I know Judge Doran, who's the, I don't know what the exact term is, he'll kill me for not knowing it, but overseer of the court system. I mean, I think he runs a pretty good ship and makes sure that any miscarriages of justice are limited as much as they can be.
And the last topic I wanted to touch on quickly, it's not going to – this piece of legislation will probably not go anywhere, but I thought it was interesting. Phil Pomisano, obviously a local assemblyman, wants to ban supervised injection sites across the state. Democrat Linda Rosenthal from Manhattan is sponsoring competing legislation that excuse me, that would allow it across the board. It's interesting because this is something that's been debated and discussed for Ithaca. I don't think it's the best practice or the best way to correct this. They've tried to show some case studies in other states and other places where similar systems have been implemented. I think it's a half measure, ultimately. If you're going to put the staff in a facility like this, if you're going to put the security into a facility like this, if you're going to pay the law enforcement cost for what would likely happen outside of that facility and nearby that facility, if you're going to pay for all those things, why not just pay for treatment beds? Why not just pay for more complete treatment at all ends of the spectrum? And three, really make sure that the turnaround time between when folks overdose or interact with the law because of a specific drug substance issue, that they're immediately able and there is no turnaround time for that first step of care, for that first step of treatment. Because that is really like that when we talk about correcting or ending the opioid epidemic, that is the only way that it's going to happen, is by making sure that that care and treatment is complete all the way around.
Well, and I'm happy to see that even among law enforcement, you know, I've had a number of the sheriffs on, and I think most of them agree that it's not just a law enforcement problem, and maybe not even primarily a law enforcement problem. It's a medical problem. And, right. You know, supervised injection brings up a lot of questions because there are people who say it encourages drug use. And I suppose to a certain extent it does. If you make it easier, then it's going to happen. On the other hand, the feeling is that drug use is going to happen anyway. If it is going to happen, let's have it be as safe as possible. So it just brings up a lot of – we still haven't developed a coherent overall way to treat substance taking in our society, because we still have a substance in alcohol that is the most dangerous of all, bar none, not even close, and it's legal, taxed, regulated, and accepted in society. So I think part of what we have to do is sort through our attitudes about all these substances and decide once and for all that they're either bad or they're good.
Well, and I think a lot of this, honestly, could be addressed through some form of healthcare reform. And I don't mean in terms of making it easier to find, to have treatment approved per se, but actually to just ensure that folks aren't as frequently, and I know some steps have been taken in this way to ensure that folks aren't being medicated the way they have been historically. That I think is probably the area where we still have a lot of opportunity. And even if it just means, and some folks will probably hear that and say, well, geez, if the doctors aren't prescribing, you know, painkillers for 30 days anymore, and they're only prescribing them for 3 days or, you know, 5 days or maybe a week or 2 weeks, you know, that's so much better. That's so much, well, maybe we should look at ways to potentially not have to use painkillers, except for those extreme cases.
Well, and not just painkillers, but medications in general. That's another part of the puzzle that we haven't really come to grips with yet, is that we shake our finger at people and say, don't use drugs, and then we turn on our television and we're told that for every single problem that could ever possibly befall us today, there's a drug that will take care of it. So, and there's a huge, huge, extremely profitable industry built around those drugs. So it's all part of that whole, unfortunately, the whole healthcare debate in our country has just become keep it the way it is or go to some kind of socialized system, and there's such a resistance to any kind of socialized system that we're stuck. The figure is that per capita in the United States, we spend more than twice as much per person on healthcare than almost every other developed nation on earth. That's setting aside all the policy, but we're spending too much, and we just have to come to grips with this whole contradiction. On one hand, turn on the TV, here's a drug, take this drug. We have, you know, all the charitable organizations do fundraisers. What do they serve? Wine. So we still haven't come to grips with our whole attitudes about mind-altering substances as a society.
Well, and then the flip side of it is we have the same discussion when we talk about higher education, right? Like we're literally talking about cost being out of line with what it really should be. And it goes to the value issue. It goes to the opportunity for care issue. It goes to all of the access. All of these things that I think are just pretty much putting us in a place where a lot of folks want to believe that single payer is the perfect solution. Seems to be that the other half of the world wants to keep it exactly the way it is now, and that's the perfect solution. Neither's right. You got to go with some nuance. Jackie Augustine, she's been drilling that phrase into my mind for the last 2.5 years, and by God, it's finally sticking. You have to have nuance in your solutions, and it is not going to happen with a simple single-payer solution or with keeping the system exactly as it is today. They're going to have to get their hands dirty. It's going to take time, and they're going to have to actually go against the people who are making money hand over fist, profiting off of the system the way it exists now.
And there's the rub. That's what, in a lot of our public policy questions, it's, you know, follow the money, as someone once said. See who's making a lot of money. And that's the healthcare debate in our country is almost exclusively on who's going to pay. Are we going to do it the way we do now through private insurance? Are we going to do some kind of single payer, government payer, rather than the whole overall issue of, you know, why do we need so many drugs? Why are we so obese? Why do we eat terribly when we know we shouldn't? There's a lot of bigger questions there that should be asked as part of this debate, but so far aren't being asked.
Yeah, and this is one of those things where we can talk about it and folks can argue about it and debate about it, but at the end of the day, I don't think we've reached, or frankly, I'm not sure we will reach our tipping point anytime soon. And it really does call into question some fundamental stuff where you start to wonder how long can the system survive the way it exists right now and how long before we sort of have that disastrous outcome.
Well, we're solving some of these problems on these podcasts, so we'll tackle healthcare. We'll have a solution on the next one.
So one more time for the folks listening and watching, where can they hear you Monday through the end of the week?
It's on the Finger Lakes Morning News. That's Finger Lakes News Radio in Geneva, 95.1 FM and 1240 AM. We apologize that it was down for a while. It's back fixed. And that's WGVA in Auburn, 98.1 FM and 1590 AM WAUB.
All right, we got it done. We'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, stay informed, keep reading.
All right.
See ya.